Right, well, it's great. It's wonderful to be here. I have a soft spot in my heart for Toronto because I, during a visit to Toronto about 20 years ago, where should I put it? Here?
Right here.
Is that okay? Right. Where I realized it would be fun to be a professor, so I have a soft spot in my heart for you all. So I'm going to talk about two topics today. One is about some chemistry related to a new branch of superconductor that the world has been interested in lately. And the second thing is about topological insulators, which are a hot new topic in condensed matter physics. And I know it's a general audience, so I hope this will serve as a nice introduction to the way we think about some things in the borderline between materials chemistry and materials physics. Now, this is the young man who's a postdoctoral fellow in my research group, and he's responsible for a lot of the work you're going to see. We just moved into a beautiful new chemistry building, which is lovely on the outside, but chaos in the laboratory. Every experimentalist's worst nightmare has come true. None of the equipment works. The power is funny. The water is strange. So someday we'll be back to work, but right now we're just writing papers and things like that. So superconductivity is a manic depressive field, where we go through these years of depression where nothing interesting seems to be happening, and then all of a sudden somebody does something completely crazy and discovers a new kind of superconductor that turns the world upside down. And the last time that happened was in January of 2008, when a scientist in Japan who had actually been trying to invent a P-type, a whole current carrying transparent conductor, took iron arsenide, a compound of lanthanum, oxygen, iron, and arsenic, doped it with fluorine of all sorts of crazy ideas, and I can't imagine what was in his head, and discovered that the material was superconducting at 26 Kelvin. Now, what's strange about that is two things. The first, the most strange part about it, was that it was published in the Journal of the American Chemical Society, which is where nobody ever publishes a paper about superconductivity. The second thing is that it was made with iron. And iron, as you know, makes magnets. So the right away, people got really excited about this superconductor because magnetism usually trumps superconductivity. If you have a competition between two states and one of them is ferromagnetism, the magnetism is just going to win. So you would expect anything that you have that make with iron in it to be a magnet. So it was very strange that something with the iron could turn into a superconductor. There were a handful of them known before. They were largely unremarkable due to their low superconducting transition temperatures. But this one is 26 Kelvin. That's now getting rather high. And the highest TC we know of in this family is now 55 Kelvin, which makes these iron-based superconductors the second best ones that anybody knows about. So the moral here is, any day you can wake up and somebody can have done something crazy that generates a really high temperature superconductor, and that's what makes the field so manic depressive, right? You're depressed because you didn't do it, and you're manic because you really want to work on this right away. So let's look at what these compounds look like. They have just like many classes of materials, they have an active electronic layer where all the interesting things are happening electronically. And the rest of the crystal structure acts as kind of a support or a way to affect the charge on this important layer. So let's look at this right here. This is a barium iron 2 arsenic 2. It has a structure known as the thorium chromium 2 silicon 2 structure type. It has a layer of irons surrounded by arsenics, and you can see that the iron is in a tetrahedral coordination with arsenic. We'll talk a lot about that later. And this layer extends infinitely through the crystal. It has another layer here, and there's a barium atom in between. So this material by itself is magnetic, but when you dope it with potassium, like we make a random solution of potassium in place of barium, at around 40% potassium, you generate a superconductor. Just like alcohol and water mix, atoms can mix in crystal structures and solid structures. That's called a solid solution. So potassium doping of this guy makes a superconductor. Here's another one. Here's the iron arsenic layer again. with the tetrahedra, and here's a different kind of layer in between. It's a lanthanum oxide layer. So this is the electronically interesting part. The other things just separate those layers. We had an interesting phenomenon. I'm sure you have it in your branch of physics. I'm not sure whether you do, but we have CONMAT, which is the preprint server. And basically, this field exploded because of the use of this web server, which could get information around the world in 12 hours. Basically, you upload your preprint. 12 hours later, everybody on Earth can read it. So it took a field that normally might have taken months or years to develop and made it develop in a matter of weeks. So many, many superconductors were discovered after this first one was discovered, and their crystal structures are all kind of schematically shown here. Here's our active layer of that iron arsenic or iron selenium layer, and then other kinds of layers in between. But the basic principle being that once the community understands what the electronically active part of a crystal structure is, it's not so hard to try to invent other crystal structures that are related to it by putting other layers in between. And this all developed in a period of weeks in the iron arsenic superconductors. I like to say that superconductors are like people. There's an optimal complexity, and once something gets too complicated, it doesn't work anymore. So the original superconductors were simple. They're good superconductors. The more complicated you make them, the worse they work, just like people. Here's how you make these things. You have to be very careful about controlling the oxygen in these materials. We're not going to talk about how you make them, but in chemistry, you know, it's all about how you make it. And different people can be trying to make the same thing. Doesn't always come out the same way. And here's an example of how you have to do it. You have to take finely polished iron and selenium pieces. You seal them in an evacuated quartz tube. To keep the oxygen out, you need something that likes oxygen better than your sample, and that's high-density carbon. You seal that whole thing up in a second tube, so in case something goes wrong, nothing leaks out or in. Then you make a whole series of samples here by varying the formulas, and you see what you get. So the chemistry is a lot of fun and complicated. Physics community is trying to figure out why these things superconduct. The Coup rates, the real high TC superconductors set this all up. In those materials, there's a competition between magnetic ordering and superconductivity. And as the magnetic ordering is destabilized by changing the chemistry, superconductivity appears. So the function of the chemist is to destabilize the magnetic states and so that the superconducting state can eventually win. And the same thing happens in these iron arsenic superconductors. They start out as some kind of a magnet. In this case, not the same kind of magnet that you have in the cuprate superconductors, but you do the chemistry on them, and then you have a phase diagram where the magnetic state, the stability of the magnetic state goes away. That's shown by this line here, and the superconductivity appears. So this is a typical kind of phase diagram where you have competing states in solid state systems. You destabilize something by doing chemistry to the point where superconductivity can finally win. Physicists are asking, how does magnetism evolve into superconductivity? Is this superconductor here an interesting one or a boring one? Why is the transition temperature to the superconducting state so high? That's what the physicists are busy answering. For a material scientist, the question always is property structure relationships. What is it about the structure of this compound that gives rise to superconductivity? What is it about the chemistry of this compound that gives rise to superconductivity? Those are the questions we are trying to answer. These are really interesting compounds from a chemical perspective. Here's the periodic table right here. I like to when I show this to organic chemists, I say, this thing is called a periodic table. Maybe you never saw one of these before. You're used to thinking about something like iron, steel, you know, is based on iron, manganese, cobalt. Here's the metallic elements in the periodic table. You understand what a metal is like. It's a ductile object. It's shiny, reflects light, conducts electricity. Sodium chloride is an ionic compound because there's a big electronegativity difference between this side of the periodic table and this side. So these guys transfer their electrons to this side, and everybody's happy. So in a metal, you share electrons. In ionic compounds, you transfer electrons. What about iron and arsenic? What kind of compound does that make?
Well, here's iron, here's arsenic. They're both metals. Iron is a metal, arsenic is a metal. What kind of compound is that?
What's interesting about these iron arsenic superconductors is it's hard to know what kind of compound that really is. It's not as ionic as sodium chloride, and it's not as metallic as an iron cobalt intermetallic alloy. So it's hard to know how to think about this compound. And in particular, it's hard to know how to count electrons here. And chemists love to count electrons, and physicists count electrons too. They worry about band filling and things like that. We have to know how to count. And these are interesting because they're ambiguous. So I'm not going to talk about the superconductors themselves, but I'm going to show you what we got to when we started to ask, does chemistry matter? Does chemistry matter in these superconductors? They have the thorium, chromium 2, silicon 2 structure type, which looks like this, as I showed you before. Big atom in the middle, metal atom, square plane, and then these tetrahedra. Now, believe it or not, this is the most common crystal structure occurring amongst intermetallic compounds. When you have three metals that are different, the most frequent crystal structure that you see is this one. So that is interesting. Why is it this one? Right? I don't know why, but it's the most stable of all of them. It happens for borides, aluminides, gallides, silicides, germanides, stannides, phosphides, arsenides, antimonides, sulfides, and selenides. Almost every element in the periodic table forms this crystal structure. I like to say that it lives in the world of perfect intermetallic physics. And in intermetallic physics, structure is simple, properties are interesting, and chemistry doesn't matter. Don't have to worry about bonding or structure or anything. I'm just dumping electrons into a box. They have wave function. I get an interesting property. The end. But in spite of that, a very clever chemist named Roald Hoffman, who eventually won the Nobel Prize, looked at this crystal structure and said, you know what? There's something strange about that crystal structure. It's not just a bunch of metal atoms sitting in there together, filling space in this way. It's something interesting can happen. And he looked at the phosphide, the ones that are made with transition metals, phosphorus, and a large A atom. And he noticed that when you have this crystal structure, these things right here, which can be phosphorus or arsenic or tin or germanium or antimony, when they're close enough together, they actually can form a bond. A chemical bond can form between these two things. In other words, it's like a dimer. It's like a molecule inserted inside a metal. That's curious, because this molecule, it's like a little, you know, we don't have molecules in solid state physics. We have extended solids where you can understand all the electronic properties in terms of periodicity and electrons and wave function, things like that. You never think about having a molecule inside a solid compound like this. But he noticed that there was a molecule in there. And in fact, he noticed that when this atom is small, these things are close together and they form a molecule, a phosphorus-phosphorus dimer. And when this atom is big, this distance between the layers is big and the phosphoruses are separated. So what happens is when they're far apart, they're individual phosphoruses. When they're close together, they form a molecule. In other words, phosphorus, which has five electrons, can accept three if it's not bonded, but can only accept one if it is bonded, and I'll show you a little tutorial on that coming up. When was the last time you took freshman chemistry? Well, the freshmen are taking it, but the rest of you have, it's been a long time. So here's how to think about a dimer. Here's our P states on our phosphorus. Here's our three P electrons that are normally in our P states in phosphorus. When I form a dimer, I form bonding orbitals and antibonding orbitals. The antibonding orbitals are high in energy. The bonding orbitals are low in energy. I fill from the bottom to the top. If I have a lot of electrons in bonding orbitals, then my dimer is strong. Those atoms stick together. They're close together. They're strongly bonded. As I put more and more electrons into this molecule, when I get to the point where I fill all six of these antibonding orbitals, the molecule falls apart.
There's no more binding because the number of electrons of higher energy balance the number of electrons of lower energy, and there's no dimer. So if I add, here's my phosphoruses, if I add four electrons to my two phosphoruses, I still have fewer antibonding electrons than bonding electrons, and I still have a dimer. If I add six electrons to here, then I have no more dimer. It comes apart because I filled all the antibonding orbitals. And I can tell which case I have by the distance between the phosphoruses. So here, when they're far apart, I have no dimer. When they're nearby in the crystal structure, I have a dimer. This was fun. This was fun for chemists, but it had no implications until recently. And in 2009, some physicists took calcium iron 2 arsenic 2, which was not superconducting, and they squeezed on it. And under pressure, calcium iron 2 arsenic 2 becomes a superconductor. And then as you squeeze that on some more, superconductivity goes away. And that's shown in this chart here. At one bar, it's not superconducting. At a half a GPA, it becomes a superconductor. And at 1.25, this is 12 kilobars in other talk, it becomes a metal again. What was happening? What was happening was the lattice was collapsing. So they were squeezing these arsenics closer together. At some point, under pressure, the arsenics got close enough to form an arsenic-arsenic bond. And right at that point where they formed the bond, superconductivity seemed to appear. They called this a collapsed tetragonal phase. So as you bring the thing together with pressure, all of a sudden the layers collapsed on each other and they got a superconductor. Physicists concentrated on the pressure-dependent properties, but a chemist can ask, I already told you what I think, that the formation of the arsenic-arsenic bond drove the collapse and it made the superconductivity appear. I'm talking too slowly. I have to skip the next 29 view graphs to get to the end. All right. Strontium cobalt 2, so we'll do this now. Here's the crystal structure. Chemists ask, can we use chemical pressure instead of applied pressure to control the crossover? So very few people do pressure experiments. You have some crazy people in your department that do them. They take years and years. I saw them today. They're wonderful, sophisticated experiments, but they're very, very difficult. What a chemist would like to do is to take elements, stick them in a pot, heat them up, and do a pressure experiment in a matter of days that it takes these guys years to do. Okay? We can do that in some cases, but not in all cases. Of course, we introduce disorder, which he doesn't like. But, okay. So, what we're going to do is we're going to look at strontium cobalt 2 P2 and calcium cobalt 2 P2. Calcium is above strontium in the periodic table. It's a small atom. Strontium is a big atom. So, when we mix calcium, when we look at the crystal structures of these two things, calcium should have a crystal structure that has smaller repeat distances than strontium. So let's see what happens. Here is the in-plane lattice parameter of the calcium. It's bigger. So the calcium, even though calcium is smaller than strontium, the unit cell is bigger in this square direction. For strontium cobalt 2 P2, the unit cell is smaller in this direction, but look how much bigger this is. This is a 20% difference in size from atoms that are only different in size when the atoms are only 10% different in size. So there's a dramatic change. So first thing we're going to do is we're going to do the chemical pressure experiment instead of the regular pressure experiment. We're going to put calcium in place of strontium. We're going to bring the two phosphoruses together slowly by changing the size of the balls in between the layers. As they come together slowly, maybe they're going to form a phosphorus-phosphorus bond when they hit a critical separation. And how are we going to notice that? We're going to notice that by looking at we're going to look at how the crystallographic cell changes. So here's this in-plane lattice parameter as a function of calcium substitution. Here it is, I'm putting a smaller billiard ball in place of strontium, but all of a sudden when it hit 50%, the thing shows this bizarre S-shaped increase. So right when you hit this critical composition, something happened to the crystallographic unit cell. Something electronically must have happened to create that anomaly. And what happened to create that anomaly is that you started with a phosphorus-phosphorus separation of around 3.3 angstroms in the strontium cobalt 2 P2,
And when you got the calcium cobalt 2 P2, that distance shrank by an angstrom. So that's a 50% difference in separation. And when you take two atoms that are 3 angstroms apart and you put them 2 angstroms apart, now you've created a bond. So what's happened as you cross this phase diagram is they've come closer together, and the phosphates are just slowly coming closer and closer together. But when they hit this magic bonding spot, now the rest of the crystal structure doesn't know what to do, because all of a sudden I go from isolated phosphoruses, which have a charge of 3-, to this dimer where each phosphorus has an effective charge of 2-. So now something dramatic has to happen. The electrons have to rearrange in the rest of the crystal structure. And when they rearrange, there's a dramatic change in the crystal structure, the rest of the crystal structure. Both of the end members are weak magnets, but in the middle you get a ferromagnet. I won't go over these things so I can get to the end of my talk. But there's a divergence, and the physical properties diverge at the formation of this phosphorus-phosphorus bond. So right at the point where I'm creating a molecule inside a metal, there's an electronic instability that is reflected in the divergence of the magnetic properties, the most dramatic being the magnetic susceptibility. So right at this point where you see this S shape, where we've just formed this bond, I get a divergence in the low temperature susceptibility shown here. It's a unique example of using this kind of substitution to move electrons around in a solid. I've made a molecule inside the solid and I've moved electrons. It's the only case we know about. Here's a picture from Roald Hoffman's original paper, and there's a lot of interesting chemistry in this story. So you know that the d orbitals, that there are 10 electron states available in the d orbitals. So if you put them in a solid, you have a band of states that's derived from the d orbitals of the transition metal. So we're going to go across the 3D transition metal series. As you go across the 3D transition metal series, the 3D orbital energies go down. So as I go from manganese to iron to cobalt to copper, the average energy of the 3D states goes down. But as I go across the series, the number of electrons in the D states goes up. So I start with manganese that has 5, and I go to copper that has 9. And so the effective filling of this band of available D states, the effective filling goes like this. And Hoffman, this is from the original 1985 paper, he says, well, the bonding orbital of this dimer is down here, and the antibonding orbital is up here. So for manganese, the antibonding orbital is filled. You should have no dimer. And for copper, you should have a dimer. So as you cross the periodic table, all of a sudden, when you get to around here between cobalt and nickel, that dimer should become stable because the antibonding band becomes empty. That's a prediction, never tested for 25 years. So we did the experiment. We kept everything constant, and we just moved across the periodic table. We went from iron, calcium iron 2, phosphorus 2, calcium cobalt 2, phosphorus 2, to calcium nickel 2, phosphorus 2. And if you look at that, you can make a continuous series of compounds where you change the iron to cobalt ratio or the nickel to cobalt ratio. You can titrate in between the elements of the periodic table. And there's a big lattice collapse of the unit cell. And here, instead of shrinking, you learn in freshman chemistry that atoms shrink when you go across the periodic table. So this parameter should just shrink, and in fact it grows. So what's happening right here, right where Roald Hoffman predicted it, is that the antibonding orbital is emptying out. This is completely contrary to everything, to all simple, let's say simple pictures of intermetallic compounds based on 3D transition elements have a 3D band of states. As you go from one transition element to another, that 3D band just kind of fills up with electrons, and all the properties that you see can be explained by the change in electron density as you go across the 3D series and put more or less electrons in the D orbital band. But the big thing that's happening in this system is that the electrons, as they're going in, instead of going in the D band, are going to create the phosphorus-phosphorus molecule. So everything in the crystal structure stays constant as you go across this series now across many
many electron counts in the periodic table, but the strength of the phosphorus-phosphorus molecule is increasing. So here we have a phase diagram that is a strange thing. You can't explain it by a simple band filling like you would in a normal intermetallic compound. You have to worry about the creation of a molecule inside a solid. And so I think that this system is at the boundary between physics and chemistry views of electrons and solids. You can't explain it without the molecule. Right. So the way I am is, once I get my idea, my brain on something, I can't let go of it till I beat it to death. And sometimes beating something to death is a good plan. Sometimes it's not a good plan. In this case, the last thing, what we tried, we said, well, if all these things are true, then you should be able to manipulate one more chemical parameter to verify this picture. No periodic table in this room, but phosphorus is got 5 electrons, 2 s electrons, and 3 p electrons. Over one to the left is silicon and germanium. They have one fewer p electron. So remember that picture of the dimer. If I have one fewer p electron per metalloid, per phosphorus or germanium, then my antibonding states are going to be more empty more of the time. I need to get more electrons into this thing to fill the antibonding states. So germanides in this crystal structure have germanium-germanium bonds all the time. Okay? And the phosphorus, so what's going to happen if I mix germanium and phosphorus together? So here's strontium cobalt 2 P2. The phosphoruses are far apart. As I put germanium in, I create a dimer. And when I create the dimer, let's look right here at this unit cell. As I take electrons out, I create the dimer, and it makes the lattice collapse in this direction. So there's a very, very strong lattice collapse transition as I take phosphorus and I replace it with germanium. Okay. Yet another example of this, who cares? But in this particular case, something interesting happened in the middle. Strontium cobalt germanium 2 is not magnetic. Strontium cobalt 2 phosphorus 2 is not magnetic. But right in the middle, where you're just beginning to form the dimer, something interesting happens. And the interesting thing that happens is that you make a ferromagnet. So you take two non-magnetic things, you mix them together, and you get a ferromagnet. It's very, very rare. And you can do all sorts of characterization measurements of showing how you get a ferromagnet, the typical plots of magnetic properties as a function of composition. We're not going to worry about those. But then we notice something interesting. You take most chemical systems and you do some chemical doping. He doesn't like to do it because it introduces disorder. Right, he's right. So you take a chemical system that has some kind of magnetic property, you mix elements together, you create a lot of disorder in the system, and typically the magnetic property just kind of dissipates into oblivion. It never does interesting things before it disappears. In this particular case, the magnetism actually is slowly titrated so that the ferromagnet grows up, appears with a very, very low temperature magnetic transition first. In other words, it's what the condensed matter physicists call a quantum critical point. It means that this thing, when the ferromagnetism turns on, the TC is near 0 Kelvin. Ooh, we have some people who study quantum critical points around here. Good topic. So here's a very bizarre quantum critical point. It's a quantum critical point that's induced by the creation of a phosphorus-phosphorus dimer. And the characteristics of these kinds of things involve the power law divergence of specific heat at low temperature. Here's an example. So on two compositions on either side of our quantum critical composition, we have a lower specific heat. But for our magic one, which is approaching a 0 Kelvin ferromagnetic phase transition, we have a funny divergence. And as a physicist friend of mine once said, sometimes when you mix two vegetables together, you get caviar instead of guacamole. So that's caviar. So here's an electronic phase diagram. It's a dimer breaking induced quantum critical point. So this kind of phase diagram, we have ferromagnetism in the middle between two non-magnetic states, and the magnetic transition goes down towards zero Kelvin, is a very rare thing in physics, and it's induced by the breaking of this bond. Good. I am going to get to the end of the talk. And this is another topic altogether, and it has to do with introducing you, I hope, to an interesting new class of electronic materials called topological insulators. The physics of topological insulators is well beyond my knowledge, but I am part of a collaborative team that has worked to, let's say, discover these materials and find some of their interesting properties. And since this is a general audience, I'd like to explain to you why they're interesting and show you some of the simple experiments that physicists have done that show why they're interesting, and explain to you why it's a hot topic in condensed matter physics right now. So the crystal structures I just showed you have layers in them. And the one true statement that you can make is that if you confine electrons to layers, you get interesting physics. And the more you can confine them to those two layers, to a two-dimensional system, the more interesting your physics gets, right? If these are extended solids, the bonding is in all directions, and so there's always some kind of interactions of electrons in the third dimension, but if you can make them really 2D, really interesting stuff happens. So charge density waves and superconductivity and bulk magnetism and bulk materials are induced by low dimensionality, but truly exotic low dimensional systems have only been seen in artificial materials until recently. Most famous examples being indium gallium arsenide phosphide. You take a beautiful, perfect crystal of indium gallium arsenide phosphide, you embed it between other perfect crystals, you have a buried layer that a human being has made in their lab. If you make it really, really perfect, you can see fractional quantum Hall effect and win the Nobel Prize. You can win two Nobel Prizes for that, one for the original quantum Hall effect and one for the fractional thing. But the idea being that if you make things 2D enough, things get interesting. Oh, I don't need to tell you much about graphene. There was another Nobel Prize for that one recently. You take graphite, you exfoliate it. You can exfoliate till it's only two layers thick, and now you're confining electrons in something that's really, really thin. The physics is wonderful and exotic, and the last 10 years have been really fun for people who are interested in graphene, because exotic physics happens. You can take this stuff and shave it in your lab. People do it here, and interesting things happen. Some theorists who are working on graphene were inspired to think about some other materials, and they came up with something that's very rare in materials physics. So two or three theorists at University of Pennsylvania said that if you look on the surface of specific crystal, and the crystal they said was bismuth antimony alloy, if you look on the surface of this crystal, the electrons on the surface of this crystal are going to have an exotic state of matter, an exotic electronic state of matter. And that state is very strange. Basically, the electrons are photon-like, meaning that the energy goes as the wave vector, not the wave vector squared. So they have a very, very low mass. They're chiral. The spin direction and momentum, the electron momentum and its spin are locked. They cannot be separated. So the electrons on the surface are chiral. And because of this chirality, the states on the surface are immune to scattering, amongst the predictions. So they said, if you look in this specific place for this specific effect, you're going to see it. That is almost something that never happens in condensed matter physics, because systems are just too complicated to do that. So Zahid Hassan, who's in our place, came to me one day and said, Bob, these two theorists have predicted that on the surface of a bismuth antimony alloy, there should be this exotic surface state with a new kind of electronic state of matter nobody has ever seen. He said, can you make that? I said, I have it in a drawer. I opened the drawer. We were looking at it for some other reason. And there it is. We had crystals of bismuth antimony that we were making for some other reason,
Bismuth is a semi-metal, and antimony is a semi-metal, meaning that there's states at high energy that cross states at low energy. They're not at the same momentum in space. And in antimony, they're inverted in some way. And right in the middle, a band gap opens up, so it's a low band gap semiconductor
right at this composition of 90% bismuth, 10% antimony. It grows beautiful crystals in a simple apparatus. And on the surface of this thing at room temperature is one of the most exotic electronic states known to humanity. It's just sitting right there. Nobody ever looked for it.
I like to say that you can make it in your lab in furnaces that look as pretty as this instead of things that look as pretty as that. And there is the material. So Zahid, in a series of experiments that took him 2 years, was able to confirm the theorist's prediction that there are surface states. And this is a photoelectron experiment that is angle resolved, meaning it can look at the electron wave vector and energy. And these are the surface states shown here. And these states right here are the topological surface states, and they are chiral, which I'll show you in a second. So here's the Fermi energy right here. The bulk states are shown in these cartoons, but here are the energies of the surface electrons. We're going to look at these guys right here. So this was the first experiment that he did that showed that these states were actually present. The cool thing that he did was to do a photoemission spectroscopy experiment where we could test this idea that the electron states were chiral, that their wave vector and their spin direction are coupled. So here are these states that I showed you before. Here is this is the gamma point in the Brillouin zone, and here we are going along one direction. This is a section through this thing, which is actually a circle. And we're going to look at the spin direction on this side and this side of this cone right here. And you can take an analyzer that only detects photons, electrons emitted with one spin chirality. And what you notice is, and this is our instruments that are just now been developed, that here's one spin up. Here's the spin up electrons right here. And here's the signal from the spin down electrons. And you can see that as this is a continuous little path here, and as you look down on this path, you can see that the chirality, the spin has changed direction. Sorry, the spin is going in the same direction around this thing. So it's a chiral state. The wave vector and the spin direction are locked. Very exotic condition. It occurs in these materials in the absence of a magnetic field. The spin orbit coupling, which people in Toronto, a lot of people work on here, spin orbit coupling causes this coupling. So, there they are. The states exist. What other toys do physicists have that are really fun besides photoelectron spectroscopy? STM, scanning tunneling microscopy. I love this experiment because I taught freshman chemistry. And in freshman chemistry, you put electrons in 1D boxes and you solve. You literally, when you're a freshman, can solve the equations and figure out what the energy versus quantum number, principal quantum number relationship is for an electron in a 1D box. You can do the experiment on these topological surface state electrons. So if these are like normal electrons, the energy should go as n squared, which is something that's easy to derive. But if they're topological electrons, then it should go as n. In other words, if they act like photons instead of regular electrons, you should be able to do some kind of test. So what can you do? You can take a crystal. You can cleave it, and you get step edges. And the step edges are reflective for these surface states. Now, the tunneling through these step edges, because of this special thing about chirality, most of the electrons get through the step edge, but some of them are reflected back and forth. So you could create 1D boxes of different sizes, and you can measure the square of the wave function in different energies and different positions inside our box. So here's our 1D boxes right here. They're different sizes. And here are like the psi squared measurements as a function of energy. You can see all these little features. And then you can make a plot, and you can show
that the electron, that first of all, that the wave vector, the electron versus wave vector relationship is linear, and secondly, that the energy levels are equally spaced in N. So another prediction is true by a simple experiment. By the way, here is the Fermi surface of this bismuth antimony alloy. This chirality means if you have an electron going in this direction and it hits a surface and it's reflected back, if it's going in plus Q and it goes to minus Q, it can't scatter to minus Q because the minus Q state has an opposite spin direction. So this is what it's meant by protection. So when this guy hits an obstacle, he can't scatter backwards to minus Q because his spin would have to flip. So that's interesting from physics perspective, but also if you wanted to make a surface conduction, something with very good surface conduction, you might want to use these electrons to do it. So believe it or not, we have examples of crystals where the surface mobility is much, much higher than it is in the bulk, and we believe it's because of this protected characteristic of the electrons. They can't scatter to minus Q because the spin would have to flip. Okay. Oops, almost over. Bismuth selenide. What should I show you about bismuth selenide? A second one appeared because I don't know anything about physics, but I said, okay, bismuth. Heavy metal, makes beautiful crystals. You can cleave them. Small band gap, strong spin-orbit coupling. What else do I know that's like that? Bismuth selenide. So made bismuth selenide. It has a beautiful topological surface state with a beautiful cone. Here's our energy versus wave vector relation in bismuth selenide right here. So this is the surface state, and this is this exotic state of matter. There's a lot of interesting things to do with this kind of state. It's never really been probed by physicists before. Every day I hear a new idea from somebody about experiments that would be fun to do. I heard some today. So there's lots of nice things to do. I will skip this. Grows beautiful crystals, again, just like bismuth intermetallic. We've looked at the defects. I hate it when I have too many slides because I make people mad at me. One more thing to say before I let you go. Actually, I'm not late. Okay, I didn't have to rush through that part. Sorry. So what did we show you? Photoelectron spectroscopy. Showed you STM measurements that measure the square of the wave function. Show you something about the wave functions. And now the question is, I have these exotic electrons on the surface. What about their transport properties? You know, if you study regular solids, the transport properties of solids depend on the quantum mechanics of these electrons in the solid. And we have all sorts of experiments, over 50 years worth of studies on semiconductors that explain what the physics of those things are. These surface states now have only been around for 2 years. Their physics should be completely different from what's in the bulk. And the question is, how can I study the actual charge transport by these electrons on the surface? Now, this is a very difficult question because these electrons are only on the surface, but they're on the surface of a bulk crystal. So whereas these materials have the perfect kind of characteristic, which is that they're on crystals that anybody can grow in their lab, and therefore any scientist on Earth who has a really good idea can test it out on these crystals, because once they figure out how to grow them. The downside is that you got this big bulk piece of matter that's having all these bulk properties, but you only want to measure the conduction of electrons on the surface. And if the ratio of bulk to surface is 10 million to 1, how am I going to measure these electrons over here? So the trick is to figure out how to make the bulk crystal as insulating as possible so that you can tease out the conduction of the electrons themselves. And to do that, the part of the talk that I skipped had to do with the chemist, namely me, figuring out what were the defects in this semiconductor that gave rise to the carriers in the bulk material, and then try to get the defects out to the point where the carrier concentration got low enough that the surface states were visible in the presence of something that had 10 million times more volume from the bulk states. And we finally got to the point, well, in 2 years of work, we've now gotten to the point where we can get the carrier concentrations really low in the bulk. We can start to see the transport on the surface. And new experiments are coming out every day, but I wanted to show you one of them that my physics colleagues did very early in the game. And here's some resistivity versus temperature curves of some of our original crystals. You can see that crystal we call G5 back in the olden days had a resistivity at 20 Kelvin of 70 milliohm centimeters. Now we're 7 ohm centimeters. So we've made it more resistive by 2 orders of magnitude, which is really good. But nonetheless, this was good enough to see it. So here is a resistivity versus magnetic field curves of topological insulator as you cool it to low temperature. So here's 20 Kelvin here. This is typical magnetoresistance curve. You put a sample in a magnetic field, electrons feel the magnetic field, you move relative energies around, and the resistance changes. When you go down to 1 Kelvin or something, you begin to see these fluctuations, which are actually beautifully reproducible conductance fluctuations. And this is measured in a crystal that's many millimeters on a side. So this is very strange, because if you have electron states in a solid, they may be coherent over nanometer size regimes, but they can't be coherent over millimeter sizes. They normally, you can have little tiny regions that are coherent with respect to each other, but if you have a macroscopic crystal, they're all incoherent with respect to other regions. So any fluctuations of this type of conductance in a macroscopic crystal should be invisible because they average out to nothing. So what happens in this big chunk of this topological insulator is that these conductance fluctuations, which are due to fluctuations of the electrons that are coherent, have to exist over a very, very large length scale. And the idea being that that is only possible because the electrons on the surface are coherent over a large length scale, and that's what's given you the coherence to this case. So it's an example of a transport property that is dependent on these electrons being immune to this kind of scattering that you see in normal electrons. They create big, coherent electronic states on the surface. Lots of cool things are happening. There's an exotic state of matter called a Majorana fermion. Now, you're physicists, and this Majorana was a famous theoretical physicist who, I hear, disappeared on a boat on Lake Geneva. Is that the story? In the 30s or something like that? Predicted an exotic state of matter which is chargeless particles that display Fermi statistics, and they've never been detected. And one of the exotic things that's been proposed for using topological insulators is that the surface of a topological insulator in contact with a superconductor should be a way to observe this kind of exotic fermion that's never been observed. So my physicist friends asked me if I could think of a way to make bismuth selenide into a superconductor so that they can make multi-layers of bismuth selenide and a chemically compatible superconductor and look for Majorana fermions, and it turns out that you can actually do that by copper doping. So this is an example of what is good about chemists living in a world with physicists. Sometimes they can make a suggestion for a material that they want, and you can actually go home and make it. So here's a copper doped bismuth selenide. It's superconducting at 3 Kelvin. And so someday we hope to be able to use this to detect these exotic fermions. The other thing is that magnetism should have an effect on these topological surface states. Nobody knows what that's going to be. There's plenty of physics about the interaction of magnetic spins and ferromagnets in semiconductors. But what it's going to be like in a topological insulator, nobody knows. But it turns out that my friend said, Bob, can you make one of these topological insulators into a ferromagnet? And we could do that. So manganese-doped bismuth telluride becomes a ferromagnet at around 12 Kelvin at 10% manganese doping. So this is magnetic susceptibility versus temperature. You know what ferromagnets look like. They have hysteresis loops. Here's an MH loop for a bismuth A manganese doped bismuth telluride ferromagnet. So every day, a posting appears on ComEd of a new theory, a new idea that somebody has about something you should look at in topological insulators. Every 3 days or every 5 days, somebody does something interesting in material science that takes a topological insulator, puts it in combination with some other element, like I've shown you here, and finds a new combination of things that suggests that interesting physics is going to happen. So it's a wonderful moment in time in this field where every day something interesting appears. And it's a combination of new materials and new theory and new experiments that making it all happen. I wanted to point out something fun. My business is looking for new chemical compounds. This theorist in Uppsala did something really interesting. He took the crystallographic database. It has 120,000 compounds in it with crystal structures. He dumped 60,000 crystal structures into a band structure calculation program and calculated the surface state band structure near the gamma point, which is the middle of the Brillouin zone, on 60,000 compounds. And then put out a list of the ones that he thought should be topological insulators. Here they are. So of all 60,000 of these things, only four materials classes came out that were not previously known. But he did come up with four new ones, and that's really interesting. So what do you think? Does this take the fun out of being a scientist, or does this make it better? If somebody can take 60,000 things, crunch them through a band structure program without thinking, and come out with this many predictions, is that good or bad for condensed matter physics? Anyway. All right. End of story. Complex new materials are being discovered every day. And the goal of people like me is to find new materials that challenge the physicists to think of something new. And I hope to show you at least a couple of examples where consideration of structure and chemistry are important in determining the properties of matter. Thanks for listening.